Thorsten Wahl's now going to, who is postdoc, is going to talk to us about breaking through the quantum barrier.
Okay, thank you. So given the mysterious title of my talk, I should first of all explain why should we want to break through the quantum barrier, and what is it in the first place? So basically, why do we need quantum physics? And in the beginning of the 20th century, Heike Kamerlin Owens was the first to liquefy helium, so that was in 1908, so he could go to temperatures as low as 4.2 Kelvin, where helium finally becomes a liquid. And in 1911, he decided to measure the conductivity of certain metals. So he basically wanted to see what happens to metals as you cool them down to very, very low temperatures. So, and at that time, there were certain convictions. So one idea was that as the metal gets cooler, all the constituent particles start moving slower and slower. So, and finally, at zero temperatures, also the electrons should come to a halt, and therefore would have infinite resistance, so no current anymore. And another idea was that because the ions are not moving, so the nuclei are not moving anymore, they don't disturb the current, so actually the conductivity should be perfect, so we should have zero resistance, so very different opinions. And he also shared this opinion, so he wanted to see if we decrease the temperature, if it looks more and more like the resistance also goes to zero at absolute zero temperature. But what he measured was actually quite different. So here he is measuring the resistance of mercury as a function of temperature. And as he decreased the temperature, it didn't gradually go to zero, but it dropped very sharply at around 4.2 Kelvin to a resistance which is basically zero within the measurement accuracy at that time. And since then, it has been verified over and over again that the resistance is really exactly zero. So certain materials below a threshold temperature, which depends on the material, can conduct electricity perfectly, so without any resistance. And that's called superconductivity, and it's very counterintuitive as opposed to what we have in everyday life, where it would be the same as we had the surface where we could slide on without any friction, so where we could slide on forever. And very counterintuitive effects emerge in condensed matter systems, usually as a result of quantum physics, which is also very counterintuitive. And the laws of quantum physics were postulated in the 1920s and 30s, so most notably the Schrödinger equation. So back then, the tools were available to understand superconductivity. But it took another around 20 years until these three gentlemen came up with an explanation. And the explanation seemed to indicate that superconductivity can only exist at very low temperatures. So actually, people even try to prove rigorously, mathematically, that some phenomenon like this can only happen very close to zero temperature. Until in 1986, it was discovered that there are also high-temperature superconductors. So Bertholdt and Müller, they devised a new material, which is a cuprate compound, which has superconductivity at 35 Kelvin. And very shortly after the discovery, other experimental groups repeated the same measurement with different compounds and found higher and higher transition temperatures to superconductivity. So, and today the world record is around 138 Kelvin, so we are basically halfway through to room temperature. And yeah, but that's a serious hope. So people really seriously hope to be able to devise room temperature superconductors at some point. So, and of course, it's a big improvement over what was before 1986. So, but this was unexpected. Theoretically, it looked like these cannot exist, so the theoretical explanation is still open, but again, it will be based on quantum physics. So what I basically want to show that the laws of quantum physics are very complicated, and by just looking at them and even working very hard on them, you cannot really tell what kinds of effects they can give rise to. And another famous effect was discovered in 1980. It's called the quantum Hall effect. And first of all, the classical Hall effect, you might recall that, is observed if you have a metal and you send a current through it in one direction. So as you can see here, and you have a magnetic field in the perpendicular direction, then yet in the third perpendicular direction, you can measure a voltage. which is called the Hall voltage, and if you calculate the ratio of those two, you get the Hall resistance. And it's just a simple classical calculation to show that the Hall resistance is proportional to the magnetic field. So you just have to equate the electrostatic force and the Lorentz force on the electrons, and then you get the behavior of the resistance like this as a function of the magnetic field. Okay, but if you have the same setup at very low temperatures, what you can see is the so-called quantum Hall effect, where the resistance as a function of the magnetic field no longer changes linearly, so only at small magnetic fields, but afterwards we have these funny jumps. So for low temperatures and high magnetic fields, the resistance only takes sharp values and jumps between them, and it's given by that formula. And this formula is quite amazing because it only has nature constants. So it has the Planck's quantum and the charge of the electron, and this factor nu, that's just an integer. Like here we have nu equal to 2, nu equal to 3, 4, and so on. So we have a resistance, which is just given by nature constants, so it doesn't depend on the material. And this effect is very striking because experimentally, what people measured agrees with that up to 10 to the minus 9. So that's a very accurate effect, and it's not disturbed if we put in impurities in the metal. So if we just put in some dirt into the material, it keeps having these conductivities. And that's, again, a very strange counterintuitive effect and comes from quantum physics. So the explanation is, again, quantum physical. It has been done just 2 years later. So, and then people found an explanation why the resistance has to look like this, and nu can only be an integer, until in 1982 they found that nu can also be a fractional number. So that puzzled theoreticians quite a lot. So here you can see, so this in the back, that's the same curve as this one. But now nu has many, many plateaus, there are many, many small plateaus, and they correspond to simple fractional numbers of nu, like 1/3, 2/5, 5/2, and so on. And it took another considerable effort to find a theoretical explanation for that. It's called the fractional quantum Hall effect. And that's not just a game. It might be very important for technological applications because people are working really hard on finding, on devising a quantum computer based on the fractional quantum Hall effect. Okay, so this might encourage you to think about where does this all come from, and the answer is given by the Schrödinger equation. So if you have any material on Earth, you just need to write down the Schrödinger equation and solve it. and then you can predict anything. So like Mark basically said, it tells you everything. So this wave function tells you everything about the material quantum mechanically. So how would you do that? So these are the coordinates of the particles. So we have nuclei and we have electrons. And it's a differential equation, as you might recall. So here we have a Nabla operator. We have an interacting potential, so which comes from the fact that they are interacting via the Coulomb force. And we might have an external potential, like the magnetic field. But that's it. So it has only three terms here. And on the right-hand side, we have the energy. So it's an eigenvalue equation. Usually, we'll be interested only in the ground state energy, so in the lowest energy, since we have very low temperatures. But if you can solve this, you know everything about the material. However, that's in general very hard. So since in nature we have 10 to the 23 particles in typical materials, and solving a partial differential equation with 10 to the 23 coordinates is very hard. So even the most powerful computers cannot do that. But what I want to show you in the next slide is that it's even more hopeless than it seems. Because also in classical physics, we can have many, many atoms. You can simulate up to thousands of atoms and that way understand classical phase transitions, classical phases of matter. But if you wanted to do the same thing quantum mechanically, that's even much worse, and we can't even go to a few particles if you want to solve this equation. But I won't bother you anymore with the Schrödinger equation. So I would just call this part here the Hamiltonian, so that's H hat. And we will now talk about the wave function to see why it's really much, much harder than what it looks like. And so let us compare this to the classical case. Why is the classical case still simpler than the quantum mechanical one? Now, classically, if we just consider a couple of particles, like here are some particles moving around in a box. And if you wanted to describe the state of the system at a certain point of time, classically you only need the coordinates of these particles and their momenta, or their velocities, let's say. So these are six real numbers per particle. So in total, if we have m identical particles, this just means we have 6m real numbers. And that's, you can do this with thousands of particles. So classically, you can go to quite large system sizes, but it looks very different quantum mechanically. So quantum mechanically, so let's just start with a single particle in a box. So this is the wave function of an electron, for example. And the wave function is a complex function of the coordinate. So the electron is no longer localized at a certain position, but you only can tell what's the probability to measure the electron if you look for it at a certain position. And the probability is given by the square of the wave function, the absolute value squared. So that's quite standard. And I mean, with just one function of a real coordinate, you could still do that numerically. But it gets much harder as you add more particles. So if we have two particles, since they are identical, the wave function is described by both coordinates. So it needs to take into account both of them. That means if we square it, that tells us the probability to measure particle 1 at position r1 and particle 2 at position r2. So these are only joint probabilities. And therefore, the complexity grows much faster, because the wave function needs to encode all kinds of joint probabilities which we could investigate. So if we have m particles, if we take the square, this tells us what's the probability to measure particle 1 in position 1, particle 2, position 2, particle 3 there, and so on. So in this, what's make it very complex. So if we, for example, try to simulate this numerically, so we could put it on a lattice, so all the coordinates of the electrons are just discrete, and we could discretize the Schrödinger equation. And if we now put it on a 10 by 10 by 10 lattice, for example, we have 1,000 different positions for each electron. But we have m electrons, so this is for each coordinate, we have 1,000 numbers. So 1,000 possibilities, 1,000 different points of the grid. And in total, this means that if, in order just to store the quantum mechanical wave function of m electrons, you would need to store 1,000 to the m numbers, because you have 1,000 to the m combinations in there. And that's, of course, completely hopeless. So you might do this still for 4 particles if you have 1 terabyte, but other than that, it's completely hopeless to do this numerically. And I'm just talking about storing the state. So solving the Schrödinger equation would yet be much harder. So it's a completely hopeless endeavor to deal with these things using normal computers. And also waiting for some time wouldn't help. I mean, even if the computation power continues to grow exponentially with time, this might only mean that you can do one more particle at a time. So if you can do one more particle each year, you would need to get very old if you wanted to get thousands of particles. So it's not a very good solution just to wait for the computers. So I will introduce a new tool, which will boil the whole thing down to something that is only polynomial. So it might be linear in the number of particles or quadratic in the number of particles. And therefore, it's doable for conventional computers. So actually, we'll see that nature provides us with a simplification of this whole many-body problem. She gives us something at hand which tells us it makes it, the reality is actually simpler than we think. And I want to provide a tool which exploits that property. Okay, just to introduce that tool, it's a bit simpler to think about a so-called lattice model, so that will be a simplification. But it's actually quite accurate for many physical systems. So nature actually also provides us with a lattice. So it's just given by the coordinates of the nuclei. And so it's not, normally it's three-dimensional. Here I just draw it in one dimension. And so the nuclei, you can be assumed to be fixed. And the electrons are basically moving around them in some way. So it's just a solid. And as you know from chemistry, the orbitals of the inner electrons are quite well localized. So the S and the P wave shells. And since they're closed, they don't talk to each other. And only the outer electrons really contribute to the properties of the material. So and these are called the valence electrons. And they are more delocalized, since they're more further away from the center. And for many interesting materials, even the valence electrons are quite well localized. So they just have a very small width of the wave function. And therefore, we have a small but finite overlap with the wave function of the next electron. And this gives us a finite probability that the electron can go through this barrier. So that's called tunneling. So if you assume that the electrons have an energy like this, the valence electrons, they can tunnel through this barrier. This potential is given by the Coulomb force of the nuclei. They can borrow the energy which they need in order to go over this potential. And that way, they can hop to the next site. So this is called a lattice model. So we will just describe the whole material by sites where the electrons can reside and a certain probability for them to hop from one site to the other via this tunneling process. So it just looks like this. So that's if you make it a bit more fancy, because electrons usually also have a spin, but I won't talk about this for simplicity. You can describe many interesting materials with these kind of models very accurately. So this means we have a lattice, the electrons can hop around, and this describes us, gives us an idea of what are the properties of materials, but that's also exponentially hard. So that's just a different language of thinking of that. Okay, so but how would you really describe this mathematically? So you might recall from your undergrad studies that if you have a wave function that's a vector in a high-dimensional vector space called the Hilbert space, the Hilbert space can be spanned by an orthonormal basis, so the wave function can be written as a linear combination, as a superposition of the individual basis vectors. And that just arises from the fact that quantum mechanics is linear, so wave functions can interfere linearly. Okay, so I want to construct such a basis because this will make the description of these materials much easier. And a basis would just simply be that, first of all, we take the state where all the sites are empty, so I'm enumerating them from 1 to n. The second basis vector might be where the first site is full, so it's occupied by one electron, all the rest is empty, or just the second widest site is occupied, or the first two, and so on. So we can write the quantum mechanical wave function as a superposition of the individual configurations where the electrons can sit. And this is just the same as the expression we see here. So this would be the individual basis vectors. And this describes the quantum mechanical state of many electrons of a lattice which can hop around. And keep in mind that this here, what I'm showing on the left-hand side, is just one configuration. In reality, the electrons are in a superposition of all the different configurations at the same time with certain weights, and these are given by these coefficients. So you don't need to understand all this derivation. Maybe you can just keep in mind that this is the kind of wave function I'm using now. So that describes the state of a quantum mechanical system on a lattice. Okay, but I forgot to say this. So again, this is exponential. So we have exponentially many configurations, as you might see, because if there are n sites, each of the sites has two possible configurations, no electron or one electron. So we have 2 to the n basis vectors. So again, everything explodes exponentially. So in quantum mechanics, we have the exponential scaling problem, or if you like to call it the quantum barrier. And this exists both in the continuum and on the lattice. And I want to provide you with some tools which have been used in literature to overcome this problem. So you can, of course, always come up with an approximation and implement it on the computer, which only scales polynomially, so which you can do in a reasonable amount of time, but it might be very bad. And so there are two widely used approximation schemes which can be done on computers. I just want to give a short idea about them. So one is Hartree-Fock methods, the other one quantum Monte Carlo. But they are more or less blind approximation schemes. So it's just an idea how we can approximate it nicely, but it doesn't exploit anything we know about the physical systems. And the last approximation scheme I want to introduce, and that's the main topic of the talk, is something that uses a deep physical insight so it uses something that nature gives to us for free in order to overcome this exponential scaling problem of quantum mechanics and be able to do just calculations that are polynomially hard in the number of particles. And that's called tensor network states. But first of all, let's have a very quick look on the other ones. So Hartree Fock means that we assume the electrons not to be correlated. So that means that the many-body wave function of all the electrons can be assumed to be composed of the individual wave functions of for each electron. So there are no joint probabilities anymore. So if I measure one electron at a certain position, that doesn't affect the other electron. And this simplifies the wave function a lot. And it turns out to be an exact solution for all the problems where electrons are non-interacting. But that's also kind of obvious by construction. But if you have any interactions, you can assume it to be an approximate solution. So you can optimize it to get the best overlap with the real ground state wave function. So for interacting systems, it might work better or worse, depending on the case. And so what I can tell you is that it can describe quite a lot of effects in physics. So we have seen low temperature superconductivity and the integer quantum Hall effect. Both of them can be described in terms of this Hartree-Fock ansatz. But it fails at the more sophisticated versions of these effects, like high temperature superconductivity and the fractional quantum Hall effect. So in this case, we need something else, because here the interactions between electrons are strong, and they are the very reason for these interesting effects. So, and another possibility which you might think, okay, which researchers think of is quantum Monte Carlo simulations. So it's the quantum analog of what Mark introduced before. So we have an important sampling over the coefficients of the wave function. As I told you, there are exponentially many of them, so it makes it exponentially hard. But quantum Monte Carlo samples only over the most important ones via probabilistic distribution. And by doing so, you can get quite good accuracies for physical observables. But unfortunately, so this means in polynomial scaling, so you can do it with normal computers. But unfortunately, it fails horribly if you have fermions that are moving around each other. So it only works if the fermions are localized and they, for example, interact via the spins with each other. But as soon as they are allowed to move around each other, you have a big problem because electrons are fermions. So if you move them around each other, the wave function changes the sign, since that's a property of fermionic systems. And if there are negative signs in these coefficients, quantum Monte Carlo no longer works. So then it again has an exponential scaling, so it's of no help for us. Okay, so we need something else, and that something else is it's based on a deep physical insight, which is called the area law of entanglement. So maybe I should recapitulate what is entanglement. Entanglement is observed in certain quantum mechanical systems, like, for example, the singlet state of two electrons, so which I take to be distinguishable. So we have a red and a blue electron, and they're in a superposition of the red one being spin up, the blue one being spin down, and the other way around. And if you separate them, you can perform a measurement of the spin. So like here, part A and part B, they will always mesh opposite spins because of the construction of this wave function. And both measurements are obtained with 50% probability, but they're always anti-correlated. And this is called entanglement. And the decision which of the outcomes is observed is only made upon measurement. So that's a truly quantum mechanical effect, and it's called entanglement. But there are also quantum mechanical states which don't have any entanglement. Like if I just have a spin-up state that has no entanglement whatsoever. And of course, there's also a wide spectrum in between of states which have a little bit of entanglement or which have maximum entanglement like this one. So that's just a theoretical tool. So if you have two parts of a system, we can calculate, so of a quantum mechanical system, we can calculate how much it is entangled to the other one. And this is what I want to propose here. So again, we consider the many-body wave function of a lattice model of electrons, which are hopping around. So again, this is just one configuration. But in fact, you have to assume that the quantum mechanical state is in the superposition of all the configurations at once. And again, we have these weights. But now the interesting thing is that if you have a realistic material, this ground state wave function doesn't look arbitrarily. So there are quite strong restrictions if it's the ground state of a realistic material. And this can be observed if we calculate entanglement. If we take a block, a reasonably large block of sites, and we calculate entanglement with the rest of the system, so part B, The entanglement turns out to be proportional to the area, or I mean, the name is a bit unfortunate, so it's more the perimeter. So the entanglement between region A and region B is proportional to the perimeter, so the number of sites here. And if you just pick a generic state, like you just choose these numbers completely randomly, you always observe an entanglement that is proportional to the total number of sites in region A. So this sounds not very interesting, not very useful, since we're just talking about a reduction from an entanglement law from something that is like the number of particles to something that is only proportional to the perimeter. But this is a very strong restriction which nature gives to us. Actually, it's so strong that it reduces an exponential scaling of the quantum mechanical problem to something that is only polynomially scaling. And the idea is that if you have a realistic ground state wave function, entanglement is only carried by the particles which are next to each other, so which are sitting on opposite sides of this region A, of the boundary of region A. So you can assume that only particles which are sitting around here, they contribute to the entanglement, so that's why the entanglement is proportional to the perimeter. So this arises from the fact that nature just has short-range interactions, so particles which are far away in region B or deep inside in region A, they won't be correlated. Okay, but this just tells us that nature does some very strong simplification for us, but we don't know yet how to exploit that. So how could we possibly make our calculations, our algorithms fit this the simplification? And the answer is given by tensor network states. So they are constructed in such a way that by definition they fulfill the area law. So it's not very hard to come up with simple ansatzes which by definition fulfill the area law. And therefore they will reduce the exponential scaling to something polynomial. Okay, so I told you many things. So just to sum up my chain of thoughts, so mainly I wanted to convey the quantum mechanical problem is exponentially scaling, and I told you we could use ansatzes, approximations, but they might not always work well. So they are polynomially scaling, but Hartree-Fock only works for weak interactions, quantum Monte Carlo, not for fermions. But now I'm telling you that nature does a big simplification for us. So although she has an exponentially large space of possible vectors at her disposal, she contents herself with only a polynomially big subspace of the whole space she could actually take. And this polynomially big subspace of real ground state wave functions, that's given by the area law. And tensor network states are constructed in such a way that they exactly fulfill this area law, so they parameterize this region efficiently. Okay, I told you about tensor network states, but I should actually also introduce them a little bit. So as you might guess from the name, they are defined by tensors. So a tensor network state is given by these kinds of tensors. So maybe I should say again, a tensor is a generalization of a vector or a matrix. So a vector has one index, a matrix has two, and a tensor can have any number of indices. And in the case of tensor network states, you can write down ansatzes for the ground state wave function, which have one physical index, so that's the upper one, and a couple of lower indices. These are called virtual indices. And the number of virtual indices is just equal to the coordination number. So in one dimension, it's two, and two dimensions on the square lattice, it's four. And this physical index, its dimension is the same as the local dimension of just one site. So in one site, we can have no electron or one electron, these are the two basis states. So the physical dimension of this index is two, and the lower indices have a dimension given by this capital D, which is called the bond dimension. And this bond dimension is something you can change. So if you increase the bond dimension, you might see that this tensor has more and more entries, since the indices have a bigger and bigger range. And by increasing this bond dimension, you can make the approximation more and more accurate. So because you just have a bigger set of states over which you can optimize such that you get the best overlap with the real ground state wave function. Okay, to just give you some idea, so in one dimension we have a tensor which has three indices, one physical index, two lower indices, because coordination number is two. Now if you wanted to write down a tensor network state, so I'm doing that here, you don't need to understand the details. Mainly here I'm using Einstein summation convention, so you have to multiply the tensors in some way. But most importantly, this whole expression corresponds to the coefficients we had before. And these coefficients have exponentially many configurations, combinations. But the tensors are now, although this expression looks horribly complicated, the tensors have much less parameters. So actually, if you count the number of parameters occurring this tensor network state expression, that's two. We have two physical indices, two possibilities for the physical index. We have d times d possibilities for the virtual index. So we have 2d squared times n, because there are n different tensors. So for each side, we have a different tensor. That's the number of parameters. So any arbitrary physical state could have exponentially many parameters, but the realistic ones have only polynomially many parameters, and it's given by tensor network states, which of course also have, again, a polynomial scaling. And in one dimension, they're called matrix product states. And now I told you a lot about the ideas, so how does it really work in practice? And the answer is, in practice, it works surprisingly well. So matrix product states have been used already in 1992 for numerical simulations. So here we see the simulations using matrix product states for the spin 1/2 antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model. So that describes magnetic insulators, so that's a really physically relevant model. But it has an exact solution. So there are analytical tools with which you can solve the problem, find a ground state energy exactly. But I'm comparing this exact energy now to the matrix product state result to have a benchmark. And the exact ground state energy is shown here. The one obtained with matrix product states is shown here. So it agrees with the exact solution up to the seventh digit after the comma. So I find this really amazing, because initially it looked like the quantum mechanical problem was completely hopeless, because everything grows exponentially as a function of the number of particles. But now you can use matrix product states even for thousands of particles with incredibly huge spaces, basically, and do calculations which give you almost the exact result. And this also works for many, many other models, so that's a standard method for one-dimensional quantum mechanical models. And I want to show you also something that is more recent. And this is an application of which matrix product states have not been devised for originally. That's just an experiment which I'm showing here. So the red curve is a so-called optical lattice generated by counterpropagating lasers. And these lead to a potential which ultra-cold atoms feel. So in each of these sides, we can have an ultra-cold atom, which are the blue balls. And again, they can hop around from one side to the next one the same way as we've seen before. But now you can do real-time evolution, since it's a cold atomic experiment and you have many degrees of freedom you can play with. So in this case, people did an experiment where initially the atoms were in a state where only every other side is occupied, but all the odd sides are empty initially. And afterwards, they evolved it in time, so they let it evolve according to the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which means that this simple initial state will become a complicated superposition, because, the atoms can hop from one side to the next, but they can also do both, because they're quantum particles. They can hop both to the left and to the right and become a complicated superposition. Again, everything scales exponentially in the number of particles, but matrix product states are doing a really good job at describing this as well. So you can see this in that plot. So here we have the occupancy of the odd sides, which of course as a function of time, and initially that's of course zero, because we have no particles on average on any odd side. But as we evolve in time, finally the odd sides get occupied, and the average occupation relaxes to some saturation value. And these blue balls are the experimentally measured values, whereas the solid curve is what has been predicted using matrix product states. So although matrix product states were not originally devised for this kind of time-evolving quantum systems, they also perform amazingly well up to moderate times. So finally, let me also talk about two-dimensional systems, because that's closer to what we have in the real world. In two-dimensional systems, tensor network states are given by tensors which have one physical index and four virtual indices. because if we have a square lattice, we have four nearest neighbors, so the coordination number is four. But they won't write down the wave function defined by these tensors, since it's very complicated. And that's also the reason why it's hard to implement algorithms on the computer. So again, in principle, everything scales polynomially in time. It's doable for computers, but it's just very hard to code it. So it's the whole research on this is still in the beginning, but there are the first promising results on the so-called Hubbard model. So the Hubbard model is believed to describe high-temperature superconductivity, what we've seen before. And for the Hubbard model, tensor network states already give better results than any previous method. So in here you can see the ground state energy as a function of 1 over the bond dimension. So as we increase the bond dimension, we basically are going that way. So because we have a higher bond dimension, we have more entries in the tensor network state, and therefore we can get better and better approximations. That's why the ground state energy goes down. It gets closer to its real value. But the main problem with this specific calculation is that there are three different tensor network states which give rise to almost the same ground state energy as we improve the accuracy. And they are physically quite different. So because of that, based on this result, it's not yet possible to decide which is the real one which will survive, so which will have the best ground state energy as we make the accuracy higher and higher. But people believe that as computational performance increases and also the algorithms get better, we should be able to describe the ground state of the Hubbard model as a function of its parameters. And this would be really be a big step at describing and understanding high-temperature superconductivity. In my last slide, let me also mention some of my own work. So I've been working on two-dimensional tensor network states for high-energy physics. So what we've done here is, first of all, we simulated a system with classical quarks, which are interacting via quantum fields. So quarks are the smallest compounds of our nuclei, and they have an interesting effect called confinement. So they're interacting via fields with each other, and the fields are so strong that if you try to separate two quarks, it would take an infinite amount of energy. So because of that, they always appear at least in pairs. So you never can measure a single quark in nature. And this is something we reproduced using classical quarks. So they have just fixed positions like classical particles, and they're interacting via quantum fields. And using that, using tensor network states, we could find confining phases, so we could observe this effect of confinement. And we did this because it's what many other groups have done before in numerical simulations, because with other methods, you can also simulate classical quarks. But the quantum mechanical case, this cannot be done by any other method so far. So the quantum mechanical case, where they're treated as quantum particles, is hard because they again give rise to the sign problem. Because quarks are fermions, so quantum fields are actually bosons, that's fine, but quarks are fermions, so you cannot use quantum Monte Carlo simulations to deal with quantum quarks. So we could also do this using tensor network states, but unfortunately we could not characterize our phase diagram yet, because high-energy physicists didn't have the need yet to devise tools to find which phases are confining, because they were only working with these kinds of problems so far. Okay, but this is only an outlook. So mainly tensor network states are applied to condensed matter systems. In condensed matter systems, we've seen that the Schrödinger equation in principle gives rise to an exponential scaling problem. Everything gets exponentially hard in the number of particles. However, nature provides us with a simplification, so she doesn't occupy all these exponentially many states, but she occupies only a polynomially big subspace. And this restriction is given by the so-called area law of entanglement, and by constructing states which by definition fulfill this area law, we could reduce also computationally the computation cost to something that is only polynomial in the number of particles and therefore doable in principle. And because of that, we've seen that one-dimensional tensor network states have huge successes regarding the accuracies of physical observables, and we've also seen the first impressive results in two dimensions. Thank you.